Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Ed Solomon, who is the screenwriter of the new film, The Christophers, directed by Steven Soderbergh. It's in theaters now. It's going to be expanding wider in a bit. But I'm really excited to have Ed on the show today. Thank you for being here.
Oh, man. Thank you for having me.
So, and I say I'm really excited because I mentioned to my daughter, who is, she is 10 now, I am interviewing the guy who wrote Men in Black, which we just watched the other day. And she was so excited. She was more excited than anything, any other interview I've ever told her about. She really dug it. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. That's a big, big dad win for me.
Oh, man. Well, as a parent myself, I know the importance of stuff like that. So let me know if I can do something for her, or you know what I mean.
We'll do. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that toward the end here. But I do want to talk about The Christophers, because I've now watched this movie twice, and I find it really deeply fascinating. But the first thing, I just want to talk about how this movie came about, because I get my understanding just from reading some of the other interviews is that Steven Soderbergh basically came to you with a one sentence idea and said go, and you turned in something he wasn't quite expecting. How did this movie come about?
We were at the Brandy Library in Tribeca, just having a cocktail, saying hi, hadn't talked for a little while, and we got into a conversation about, like, what are we thinking about these days, what do you want to do with the next year, but more in a friend to friend, not work related. And he said, I really want to do one of those little ones where, you know, we control everything, like a micro budget, micro space, just a couple of actors. He mentioned The Dresser and he mentioned Patricia Highsmith. Like it'd be really cool to do a little thing with a little heisty kind of bent, maybe an older artist and younger artist and some kind of subterfuge. And I just said something about, like, what would the subterfuge be? And then we started talking about it just casually, and we came up with this idea about the inheritance, that what if this guy just despises his kids and his kids have nothing and they go to create fake versions of some art from when he was famous and leave them there for when he died. And we kind of laughed about that, and neither of us were talking about doing it as, let's do a project. We were just sort of throwing, the idea came organically, like we just started throwing ideas around about this notion. And I would say, like, 5 minutes in, something hit me in my gut, which is, for a couple decades, I'd been wanting to write about these relationships I've had with various mentor figures in my life. And my mom is a painter. And so I grew up with a studio in her garage, and she's still a painter. She's 94, and she's just had to stop painting now because her painting style was quite physical, and she can't maintain that anymore. But for her whole life, I immediately went, oh, I know who these people are. And mm-hmm. We knew we wanted to set it in London. I live in London. So that was all really great for me. And I started thinking about it and thinking about these characters that I had in my head that I really had been wanting to express. And out of that came the direction that you're talking about, that sort of moved it into a little bit more of a personal story and a little bit more of an emotional story. But also we wanted to maintain the sense of story and plot and surprise. So then it became one of those great challenges that actually frees you, meaning there were certain limitations we knew we were working with. We wanted it to have a series of, like, plot turns and still be fun and still be mysterious, but make it very character-based and in a very limited space. And within those rules was the freedom then to kind of go for it and let the characters lead the way. And this was a script written very differently than anything I've ever written before, in that I just had some vague touch points. I knew the ending. I knew that he was going to give her this thing he gives her. Mm-hmm. I knew approximate places it would go, but really, I did not do an outline that was extensive at all. I just thought about these people and tried to discipline myself to have them be, when they're dissembling, they dissemble, but begin to tell the truth sooner than you would expect. Mm-hmm. And that was the big one for me on this one. Yeah.
That's interesting. Telling the truth sooner than you would expect, because I do think that people, when they go into a Steven Soderbergh movie, particularly one that has that kind of heist twist element to it, they do expect kind of a lot of, you know, dissembling, a lot of lying till we get to the truth. Was it hard to kind of push back against that idea internally? Were you leaning that way, or was this just, you know, from the start you knew you were headed toward early truth?
What I was going for in this particularly was truth that comes out as a surprise, but also a sense of that at a deeper level, it's really honest. And a lot of times in story points where you think a character would normally lie, for instance, in this movie, when he asks her what she's really doing here and why she's here, I remember being in that moment and saying, well, actually, what if she just tells the truth? Might that be a more interesting turn for the story? And I think just in general, in writing, the crazy thing is I've been doing this my whole life. The lessons that I keep learning are as big in this decade as they were in the first decade where I was doing it. And, you know, I think the more I do this, the more I go back to the very basics. Why is this character in this space at this moment? What does this character want? And what's the truth? What does our old friend, the truth, say in this moment? Because often in writing, especially in screenwriting, especially the way they teach screenwriting these days, which is very structure and overview oriented, you know, it's like by this page, this should happen, and this page, this should happen. But the further along I go, the more I want to have faith in just what are these characters want at any given moment, and what would be the next truthful but surprising move. And when you have characters that have an emotional journey to take, sometimes those moves can be led by their own emotional journey and not your own kind of intellectual overview of what you think it needs to be.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that all makes sense. And this is a really interesting movie to navigate that with, because this is a movie about artists. This is a movie about artists trying to figure out what their art means, what their art means to them, what their art means to other people, and what the truth of it is. When you were sitting down to write, how much of your own or your interactions with Steven Soderbergh or the actors, like when you were sitting there thinking as artists, what to put into this, what kind of came through on the page?
We didn't. The movie ended up being more emotional than I think we both expected it to be. But we knew we wanted to have very flawed characters and not make apologies or excuses for the flaws, not have them overcome their flaws, so to speak. They do overcome certain things within themselves. I think a lot of Laurie, who's played by Michaela's, anger toward the Ian character is, toward Ian's character, Julian, was anger at herself, misdirected, that sort of thaws over the course of the film. I knew that in working through her relationship with Julian, that Laurie would be working out some stuff within herself. We knew, I'm thinking what else. One thing I pitched to Steven very early on. So per your first question, after we had that meeting, I went away, came back a few weeks later and sort of pitched out the story in a session where a joyful session actually, where we were completing each other's sentences. It was a beautiful thing, actually. I felt very excited that we were, hey, this, that was when I realized, oh, this is happening. I'm writing this, no matter whether anyone buys it, reads it, looks at it, wants to make it. I came back, and in that session, I said, I think it opens with an interview. And I think the entire interview is him. And as I said, him, he's like, talks the whole time. And I was like, yes, that's what I was, you know, his version of an interview is a 7-page monologue, which ends with, you know, excellent interview. I knew like that kind of thing we knew was going to happen, you know, would happen. And we had certain things we wanted to make sure we did. We wanted it to be entertaining. And we knew that there were challenges when you have limited, you know, financial, geographical, et cetera, resources, you know.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because this is, you know, this is different from some of the other stuff you've written for, you know, big studios and, you know, bigger budgets. It's smaller, it's more contained, but it definitely has a sense of space, a sense of space and a sense of time that I think, you know, works really well within the limitations here. When you were writing it, when you were sitting down and kind of looking at the space that you were going to have to use, and to clarify for folks, this the movie takes place largely in kind of a two townhouse setup. There's two townhouses next to each other. It's in London, and it's the living space and work studio of this artist who has been kind of exiled from the public eye, or who has exiled himself. You know, we could debate that point. The working within that space, when you were sitting there writing, how were you kind of imagining how the physical location figures into the story that you're telling?
Appreciate that question. Antonio Lowe, who did the production design, I think captured it beautifully. And I knew that more than anything, especially since this space was going to be so prevalent, as you said, you know, in the film, I knew that more than anything else I'd ever done, that the space had to truly be a character, that his history be represented just in a walkthrough of his home. And I think we knew that we had to add some dimensionality to the space. Like, we knew that there had to be a few floors. I already knew from the very beginning he would have two halves of separate properties connected by a pool underneath. It just felt like that bifurcated part of himself, like a personal side that is essentially empty, devoid of people anymore, but once was full of people. And that was part of in the screen direction that I had written, you know, that you can really feel that 30 years ago, this wild parties happened in here. And then a studio space that just felt both like a real painter's space, as well as a space where someone had stopped painting, you know, and kind of given up, and that there would be a duality, but that that he would really be alone in that space, and there's a moment that Stephen shot beautifully where Michaela first meets Ian, and she comes in and she's just looking at the space. And I remember even saying to Stephen, do you even want to get a shot of what she's seeing? And he said, I think we see it all on her face, you know, that she's, what she's looking at.
Yeah. I'm actually not going to spoil it for folks. I want them to sit there and watch this, the Christophers. It's in theaters now. Go see it and see that reaction shot, because some of the photos and some of the paintings that are on the wall are really, they tell a lot of the story. And there's a really interesting moment kind of later in the film where the children, who again, the character played by Julian, or the character Julian, who's played by Ian McKellen, despise, they come into the home and they're like, we should turn this into a museum. And the first thing they say is, this will be the gift shop. And it just kind of crystallizes the commodification of art, which is, you know, a big theme of this movie. But there's stuff running throughout this about selling prices, about how Julian is using Cameo to kind of, you know, pay buy dinner every night for, you know, pay his bills to the extent that he still needs to do that. When you were sitting there and thinking about the commodification of art and how that is represented on the film, how much of the space itself and the art within that space kind of played into what you were thinking about? Is that close enough to a question?
Well, I'll try to be close enough to an answer. I think in order to make the film not just feel large, but have a kind of largesse in its world, have a sense of history with the characters, have a sense of cultural placement. I was trying to write about the past and the present and the future at the same time, so that so much of their conversations, so that even when they were talking about something very specific or something right in front of them, you're seeing it in the context of a life lived. In Ian's case, a life lived for a long time, and in Laurie's, you know, not as long, obviously. That's why I love some the stuff on the walls. Like there's a photo of a young Ian McKellen, a young Julian Sklar, you know, giving the finger to the world, basically. And there's a moment in the film where he pauses looking at Laurie with that younger picture of himself and behind him, and he walks off. And that to me is, I think, an example of what you're talking about, where we were really thinking in the construction of the film to give it a kind of depth visually while being in such a small space, the implication of time and the implication of a trajectory. You see a man who's brash and defiant and proud in a photo of himself as a younger person. And then you see him, you know, defeated, let's say, or however you would want to describe it, you know, how he is now, being defiant, but without that bravura. That says a lot, and I really attribute that to the way Stephen shot it, as well as how it was designed by Antonia. You know, I noticed, you know, before each film, each project, I should say, that we've done together, I'm always fascinated with how he's constructing his cinematic language for this film. Mm-hmm. And the way he works, at least when we've been working together, is he'll kind of come up with a lexicon, a filmic lexicon, and then allow the actors to do whatever they do and then apply that lexicon to how he picks the shots. So what I mean by that is he made the decision that whenever in the house will be handheld, and that gave it a sense of intimacy that we wouldn't have had if you're just sort of on a dolly moving the camera really slowly. It also helped us in terms of the speed we needed to shoot it at, mm-hmm. but it made it feel more captured and live. So that sense of intimacy that you get from a handheld camera and that sense of depth and distance you get from just realizing that just the space that they're in has been here for a long time, you know? And that was, yeah, part of the reason to do the cultural things that you were talking about was to also to make it feel like their conversations were not just about things happening right in front of them, but actually had some cultural context. So it made it feel a little more spacious, I guess. Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah. No, that's a much better answer than my question. The cultural placement that you mentioned, and again, this kind of idea of, you know, in the background, there's hintings of a cancellation. There's, you know, the cameo. There's his appearance, his long running appearance on a sort of kind of terrible reality TV show. But all of these play into this idea of authenticity and what it actually means to have an artist do something, which is summed up early in the film, or at least addressed early in the film, when the children are talking about forging this thing, and Michaela's character says, "Well, you're not talking about a restoration; you're talking about a forgery." Mm-hmm. And they say, "What's the difference?" or something to that effect.
Yeah, does it matter?
Does it matter?
Yeah.
Does it even matter? And that's a fascinating question, because it really gets to the heart of a lot of modern art, right? What are people actually paying for? Mm-hmm. Are they paying for a discussion piece, or are they paying for brush strokes? And there's a real difference there.
I really appreciate that comment and that observation, because originally his entire set of work was going to be conceptual art. And what happened in the sort of pop and conceptual art explosion in the UK in the 60s and 70s, sort of that's the world from which he sprung, along with people like Hockney and Derek Bozier, who was initially a consultant on the film but passed away early. A woman who was our consultant, Jan Howarth, who co-created the Sgt. Pepper album cover, you know, But there was a whole wave of conceptual art that kind of exploded, and people thought, this is the new art. This, you know, art is no longer brushstrokes. Like you said, it's now becoming more and more conceptual. That was originally what he was going to do. But the problem there for me was what happened in the UK in that is after about two decades, the culture kind of went, screw that. That's bullshit. And they sort of moved back to a more painterly approach. And the problem with him being a conceptual artist only was it made his giving up not as big a deal as if then it would have been had he actually been a master at the brushstroke. And therefore, and the difference feels like it could be slight, but I actually think it's a really important distinction, because you could ask the question, as Julian asked when he was 12 years old, when Laurie is talking about a piece of hers, of his, that she saw from when he was 12 called Anyone Could Do This and Call It Art, that even he would be questioning whether or not he's an artist. So giving up is becomes a sort of strange cerebral thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that, no, he actually was a painter first and really theoretically, you know, could really draw made it more heartbreaking in a way.
Well, there's a great moment in the film where she is describing his technique to him, and he kind of realizes she is actually also an artist and a masterly painter. I again don't want to spoil any of this. Well, let's move on. I don't want to spoil the movie. But to say people should go see it, it is quite good. You should experience all of this for yourself. I want to loop back to something you had mentioned a moment ago, talking about how Steven Soderbergh kind of comes up with the language for his films, his projects. You've now worked on this Full Circle, the TV show that was on HBO Max, and No Sudden Move, which I think that was an HBO Max original. But it's they're both there. You can find them there if you want to watch them. If you haven't already, you should have. But the visual language of No Sudden Move is very interesting because he shot that film in a kind of super anamorphic widescreen that. I'll be honest, the first time I watched it, I checked the settings on my TV to make sure I had not accidentally switched into a different format. And I understand I am not the only person to have done this, but he did that for a very specific reason. And it's when you're sitting down and writing these things for him, how do you think about the spin he's going to put on them? When you're having these conversations with him and you're talking about how the film will look, how does that figure into your writing?
It all figures in the same way that I know I'm going to be writing on this computer or with this pen or in that location or with this space. It all becomes part of what you're funneling into the communication that is between you and the director or you and the ultimate receiver of the communication, the people you are really communicating with, which are the people potentially, hopefully watching the film. In the case of No Sudden Move, which unfortunately, it came out during COVID. It was supposed to be a theatrical release, but it ended up going into that mass, you know, soup that was the streaming world at that time. So that's one of the few films I've done where I wish more people had seen. So many of the things I've done in my life, I'm going to wish less people had seen or am glad nobody saw. But No Sudden Move is one that I wish people had seen. In that film, what we knew is this one originated more from Steven, even so than the Christopher's. No Sudden Move, he said, I want to do a 50s noir for Don Cheadle. And in the vein of, and then he gave me about six or seven early noir films, sort of with more kind of simple stories. And like Get Carter, Point Blank, you know, things like that. And funnily enough, as twisty and turny as that story is, I thought I was writing a really simple, little simple plot twist story. He chose. We discussed making the film, setting the film again against a cultural landscape where there already was tension, which was the freeway-ication of America, if you could call it that. There was you know, at that time in the mid-50s, Detroit was a perfect example of this. It was the beginning of the sort of redlining districts, mm-hmm. the ghettoification of certain cities because of the they were essentially flattening entire sections of the cities so that, you know, the car, the oil, the tire, the automobile industry could sort of grow their hegemony, or if that's the right word. And so we set it against that landscape. But once we said, let's do it in 1955, I said, right at this time, Detroit was half destroyed and half not. So that felt like the right time to set it. When we went to shoot it, he took the regular camera that he uses, you know, that can Arri. I don't remember the exact one, but it was a very modern camera. But he put a lens from 1955 mm-hmm. on that camera, which created that strange, distortion of the sides. And he liked it, and he stuck with it. And I kind of, one of the things I really admire, Stephen will make an aesthetic choice, believe in it, and stand firm. Something he does that a lot of directors don't do is he will shoot himself into a corner. I don't mean it in a derisive way. I actually mean he will make a directorial choice, let's say like a one-er that recomposes, and not shoot what we call coverage, meaning, mm-hmm. you know, for people who don't know what coverage is, it's basically this conversation between Sonny and I. So someone might shoot it where you see both of us, then you come in for Sonny's coverage, you see his close-up, my close-up, and you use that footage sometimes to repace or cut out of certain things. And a lot, directors usually do that for safety, you know, as well as it's important to kind of have different dimensionality, obviously, on screen. But Stephen sometimes doesn't do that. Sometimes he'll go, this is the way I'm doing it. And I think there's an excitement to that for him. And also, I think, for a viewer, because you realize there's inherently a boldness in it. And I think that lens thing, I think that issue did cause some problems for some people. But I think it was really a creative choice more than anything.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would not describe it as a problem. It definitely was a bold choice that I was reminded of when I was rewatching it for this, for this podcast. I was like, oh yeah, that's right. That was the movie I checked my settings on. Were there any moments like that in when you guys were working on the Christophers? There's the handheld when you go into the townhouse for the first time, which creates both that sense of intimacy and also confusion. You know, you're kind of off balance. Yeah. Was there anything else like that here, or was this a little more straightforward?
No, this was very improvised feel and on purpose. Because Ian sees himself primarily as a theater actor, which of course he is, and Michaela as well, they both started in theater, and I mean, Ian still does theater, and mostly. Mm-hmm. It was very important for them to rehearse, but also Stephen really likes to capture things very live and very much for the first time. So we have a relationship where if an actor wants to rehearse, sometimes I'll help them, you know, go through the script, and we spent about 10 days, Michaela and Ian and I, just going through the script so that Ian could feel, you know, that he had internalized the character. It was truly an incredible experience. Last night at the premiere, when I saw Michaela, who I've not seen for quite a while because she's filming her television show in Ghana, she gave me a big hug. We're holding each other, and she says to me the same thing I was thinking, which is, can you believe we're here from those mornings at Ian's house? Where we would go to Ian's house and sort of talk through the script. But what Stephen Lynn likes to do is let the actors do whatever prep they need to do, bring it to the floor, you know, bring it to on the day when we're shooting, and then try, especially in this one, try as best as possible to make it feel so he's shooting a documentary, you know, and it's just, we're with people and we're discovering he's discovering their emotion, their shifts as they are as characters, because Stephen is also operating the camera and along with being the cinematographer and the editor. So he knows you know, he knows exactly where he wants to feel it is, and then he will move with the scene and sometimes is designing it as he's shooting. What you get and the good, what you get from that you don't get with a lot of other directors, is a kind of speed that keeps the actors fresh. You know, in a lot of films or television shows, there's a, let's say, a crew call, or, you know, at, let's say, 7 a.m. Usually the first shot doesn't happen until 8:30, 9 o'clock. You know, you bring the cast in, they rehearse, then they go through all this lighting. But with Steven, calls at 8, first shot 8:03, 8:04. You know, the crew is there, they're all ready to go. The actors show up, sort of rehearse it once, see where they feel like going. There's not, unless there's a specific technical need, like, you know, we're cutting out of, I need you to enter this way. But usually it's just, where would you be in this moment and what feels right? Run it once or twice and then go, okay, give me a 25 on the, you know, on the wheelchair dolly and, you know, let's go. And you're just going. And it's, there's no stand-ins, no doubles, meaning what that means is, you know, normally in a film or TV show, so that you don't burn out your cast when you're lighting, you have stand-ins. So, mm-hmm. you know, but in this case, there's no need. So the actors, are, you know, he just lights quickly and around the actors. They don't have to leave set and then come back and then get back into the headspace, that you can maintain that headspace and you maintain a kind of pace and speed that makes the shoot itself an incredibly, it's going to sound very strange, but calm and relaxing and very professional experience. People treat each other really, really well, but it ends your day way earlier, which then gives Steven a chance to cut what we shot that day. So at the end mm-hmm. of the day with Steven, and I don't know why other people don't do this, we don't look at dailies. Dailies are the compilation of rough footage that you did that day. We look at a scene or two scenes or whatever we shot. We look at cut footage, which lets us assess more accurately, oh, we need this shot here, or this beat didn't quite work, did it? Not like we'd hoped. We can reshoot it, especially when you're on the same location. Let's just get that again. There are so many advantages to the way he does things, you know, that it makes Steven really the high water mark that all of us would aspire to be doing.
I mean, it's wild, the amount of work he does, the number of films that he has released over the last 5 or 6 years here, plus TV shows, plus, you know, everything else mm-hmm. that he's working on is something else. When you were rehearsing with the actors, when you were rehearsing with them and kind of going through the script, was there how collaborative was that process in terms of the actual words that, you know, the lines of dialogue that were being uttered? Was there any kind of back and forth? Did you guys kind of, you know, say, well, I don't know if she would say this, or like, how did that work?
Great question. I'm fascinated by Ian's perception of this versus mine. So I come from a screenwriting background originally. Mm-hmm. Ian comes from a theater background originally. So Ian saw me as incredibly collaborative, because I am willing to hear something, see it's not working, change it. Or get, if an actor says, this bumps for me for some reason, or this doesn't feel truthful, I can go in and I'm like, great, let's talk about why. Oh, I see. And then we can come up with a solve for that. So for Ian, that is amazing and super collaborative. It happened so little on this that for me, it was like unbelievable. Like, I only want to work with theater actors going forward. Because for me, the changes were minimal and were all good. They were always made it better. There was my first meeting with, or the first time he really, after he committed to doing the movie, he'd read the script and he said, I'll do the movie. Then I got an email from Ian. We'd exchanged email. And it said, my dear, would you mind coming to the house? I've got some script questions. Now, that terrifies me as a writer usually.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, now I'm going to go and Ian McKellen is going to tear my script apart. And my dream, because this was written on spec for Ian and Michaela without even knowing them.
Yeah.
My dream, I thought is about to get shattered when I get torn apart by Ian McKellen. And he goes, well, first, I want to point to this. He says it's here. And I feel like he would say it is. And I'm going, oh, is this where we're going? You know, so there were a series of things like that where they were very small, like word inversions, because in theater, the actor's required, if something bumps for them, to make a choice that justifies that, because they're not allowed to change words. In screenwriting, too often, and I think this is the reason a lot of movies aren't very good, to be honest, is the screenwriter is handing a script over going, I hope this helps you with your movie. Good luck, you know? So when Ian and Michaela and I were going through the script in a kind of page turn sort of way, and in particular, we were doing this for Ian. It was very important for him to have this process where he would read a line out loud, discuss his subtext, talk to Michaela about what that moment means for them, and then go to the next line, and then she'd read her line, you know, go back and forth like that. Within that setting, we hit some snags that the, you know, either Michaela or Ian would say, this feels like suddenly it's discursive and it's not emotional. And, you know, we were able to reshape whole scenes or cut things that felt like they didn't work. And my experience is that actors always have the best notes, way better than writers, because they're coming from a place of, like we talked about at the beginning, truth. And why am I here in this moment? And those questions are always the right questions. And I found when an actor is having trouble memorizing something, it's usually a writing issue, no matter how complex it is, because something on an internal level is not connecting.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, can I ask if there's for a specific example of of that in the process of making this? What was a moment where they were like, well, this just doesn't quite work?
There's a sequence where, again, without trying to give anything away, there's a sequence in the middle where they're coming from outside in, and they get into a conversation about why Julian, Ian's character, may have given up. And they started talking about the art world. And there was a moment where it went from a personal discussion about themselves to a discussion about the art world in general, which is always a mistake when I find for myself. When I start thinking I'm getting clever and I'm writing about ideas, the whole thing falls flat. And so there was a longer conversation on that stairwell, for instance, that was really about the art world. And when we hit that moment in the page turn, both actors said, I've lost the emotionality here. Like, I'm feeling this in this moment, which is anger toward her, let's say. And yet now we're having a conceptual conversation for a page. Then we would read it out loud and go, you're totally right. It's not worth it. We just pull it out. You know, that's an example. There were a couple others, because it was very important for me also that Michaela have the opportunity to go through and make sure the voice for her was felt true. And again, it was small changes with her. And there were times when they would say something like, I feel like I need a moment here to react to what they just said. You know, like I would say something here. And then I love that part of the process because almost always, in fact, I would say always, it makes the script better when an actor challenges something and is in character, you know.
Yeah.
There's a moment when the actor discovers something that is a surprise on set, it reads. There's a moment toward the end. I don't know if I say without giving up, but there's a moment between Michaela and Ian where Michaela makes a move that came impulsively and without plan, without being blocked, without being written. And there's a real power in that, in seeing it happen live. And I think that's one of the reasons that Stephen, I'm speaking for him, but you know, in my experience, as we've talked about it, likes to be seeing it fresh for himself as well, so he can capture, you know, that freshness.
Yeah. I know exactly the moment you're talking about, and you could see the surprise, I think, on the faces there when it happens. It's really interesting. Again, the name of the movie is The Christophers, and you should, if it's playing near you, should see it. You should see it when it does play near you. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked. If you think there's anything folks should know about this movie, about the state of the world, the film industry, whatever you think we should have discussed that we did not discuss. What did we fail to talk about?
A bunch of bits from my childhood that I'm still trying to resolve. I thought I really appreciated the questions and the thought in them too. Really appreciate it, and the depth. The only thing I would say, and I'm not even saying we should have talked about this, is I always feel that there are fewer and fewer movies that I can go to and have an emotional experience because it's really just about the human beings. I mean, there are those films. This, in today's world of, you know, in the world that period, but also in the way the film industry is contracting and changing, it's very rare to get the support that we have gotten from Neon in a film like this. And for people who would like to have more films like this made, it's helpful if they are interested to go see it. But but yeah. Truthfully, I mean, I think it is a different film. I hope it does hit. I hope it is as entertaining as we tried to make it be. But also, the reason I wrote it on spec and the reason that we shot it with just equity financing, meaning basically without a distributor, was so that we could make this kind of film without the interference of, you know, all the data algorithm stuff. So I would just say to expect that kind of film and honestly, performances by Ian and Michaela, and secondarily by James and Jessica, but really the Ian and Michaela tour de force performances, getting to watch them get to do that alone is rarer and rarer.
Yeah. You know? I'm just going to echo what Ed said here, which is that I hear all the time from people who say there's nothing in theaters I want to see. They don't make things for me. And the guys, they make the things that people go see. Like, if you want to see more things like this in the world, you have to go support it. So that's my soapbox. Ed Solomon, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Sonny, thank you for having me. It was really, really a pleasure. And anytime.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'll be back next week with another episode. Thanks for listening.